Hello and welcome to recording number 33 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil. Looks like this will be our last recording for this novel, and then we're going to be moving on to Sea of Death. It is August 30th, 2021. And we've just had Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy have turned Abmi into a little toad, and they have taken the second part of the second key of the Artifact of Evil from him. They seem to be toying a little with Uz, they're chiding him, much like he's a 6-year-old, which he generally acts like. And so they have kind of taken the lead right here. And it's hard to imagine them handing over that second theopart. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 331, and the fourth paragraph from the end. Yggdrasil took the opportunity to berate him for his poor choices in selecting members for the three groups of six who served him. It is just as well that Ormuz and the one called Patch chose to die in battle. Had they dared return, their deaths would have been longer and less handsome. Know you that the one dealt with lackeys of Nerl, whilst the other sought to make a pact with your father? Uz shook his head, for he could not speak. And those miserable little nothings who sought to terrorize the northern stretch of the Vesvi, all they managed to do was stir up an organized force, which slew them and their horde. Now all the forest is lost to us, for between the woodsfolk, Morden Canaan, and the dirty elves there, it will be unsafe to venture amidst the forest for some time. Both Ruttage and Bee are dead too. The impact struck Uz like a cold slap. He gritted his needle-sharp teeth and asked pleasantly, "What would you do?" "Teach that minion of yours, Halga, her proper place first," Zuckmoy said with a grating voice. "Then we will assist you in the selection of replacements," Yggdrasil added. Break. This is page 332, the end of chapter 30. So Uz has now lost control of the northern Vesvi. And this is where the story and the lore kind of intermix, because it is hard when you're dealing with these important characters and major NPCs being killed off. Then you have to really ask yourself, is this campaign lore, or is it just part of the ongoing story? There are a little of both here with where Gygax is going. So in a sense, if you're following, this is a buildup. To the campaign, or using it as events that are happening outside your player's campaign, then this could readily be actions that are going to have further reaching consequences. The second theopart, if you're using that, the destruction of a lot of Morden Kanan's forces, but also the capture of the Vesvi from Uz. Now, Uz had that secret pathway going through, the heart of the eastern Vesvi. And it took him all the way down where he could lead troops secretly right up to, across from Chendal, down south past Crockport and... Then I think even a little lower down to, around Chendal, and even maybe further to the area bordering the High Folk. So where the High Elves are. So this is a big loss to Uz, of course, gaining that second theopart if he really has it, because it's in the command of Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy right now. That's a major blow. I don't think we're really seeing too much more about the characteristics of Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy. We saw that they are, they're surprisingly when they've as they've transformed here, they like Uz was saying, they're acting almost like they're sisters here, that they have a great bond between themselves, and almost at one point Yggdrasil is giggling. So I really think we have a perspective on both Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 333, chapter 31, first paragraph. It took several days for Gord to manage the walk back to where his friends waited. Wounds from spell and hammer were worse than he had thought. And, changing into his feline form seemed to help. It also avoided the carnivores drawn to the scene of the battle by the smell of blood and death. By the time Gord came to the camp where Gellert, Chert, and the boys waited, he was nearly at full strength again, and feeling fit. His comrades cheered him when Gord walked in, but the expression his worn face bore quickly dampened their joy. Break. And Chris notes here that Uz has lost four of his six most important underlings, his greater six. And then he has lost Patch, who is a lesser six, and B, who is a lesser six, and Obmi, and who is one of the hidden six. Now, I suspect both Keek and Gleed were also part of that lesser six, and other than Obmi, who's been transformed to a toad, he may have lost all of his hidden six. So Gleed and Keek, I think, were hidden six. So, you know, if they're all dead or, you know, captured, then he is really down to just two greater six, and I don't know how many, maybe four, maybe less, of his lesser six.
And so Zuckmoy wants to kill Haga.
Yes, and that would bring him down to one of the greater six. So we have them all named out, and we could look backward and put them all together. But yeah, Uz has taken a pretty bad beating. Now I don't know, but gaining that second artifact is just, it's such a powerful force, and the help of Zuckmoy and Yggdrasil, if they are really out to help him, then yeah, he's gained far more than he's lost. All right, I'm going to restart. Page 333, paragraph 2. The news is bad then, Geller asks. Oh, I'm sorry, I wanted to comment on this paragraph too. One of the little things is that when Gord transforms into cat form, he seems to heal greater. You know, speedier healing. Now, later editions, that's, you know, a negligible thing, because healing is thrown out, into a much quicker thing to make all the adventures much pass by quicker without pauses to heal. But in this first edition, AD&D, getting an advantage without having a healing advantage, without having access to a cleric, hearing spells or potions, or scrolls or anything, that's another big advantage with Gord's ability to transform into animals. All right. The news is bad then, Geller asked. I fear the worst, said Gord morosely. Obmi escaped despite all I could do. The vile dwarf is perhaps in the hands of the Archmage Mordenkainen. For that one brought a horde of the enemy to battle and routed the humanoids. So Melf said. That one was there too. I saw him and oh much. They talked long then, Gord telling of his pursuit of Obmi, his feigned service to the demon Gratst, and the desperate attempt to prevent the dwarf from fleeing to Uz with the second key. They marveled at his slaying Keek at the very moment the crazed mage had turned the young man into a stone statue by his magic, and agreed that Melf had done a great service in restoring Gord to natural life. You might have done worse, Chert said, slapping his friend on the back and hugging him warmly, to have rid the world of the likes of Keek as a service to all. After a bit more discussion, they shared a meager supper and retired. There was much to do now. It was time to get from the forest as swiftly as possible and get word to those who waited as to what events had taken place. Perhaps it was already known, but the probability of the passage into the hands of the Cambion, of that instrument of evil, was of utmost urgency to relate. They slept uneasily and rose before dawn. All right, break. One of the things that's kind of occurred to me here is, you know, when they got transported to the Cat Lord, I seem to remember that Curly left in order to pursue the artifact. And yet, you know, there was absolutely no word of Curly. Now, Melf and Biff also survived, but they went back to Morden Canaan. So I'm really wondering why, you know, what happened to Curly and why he wasn't there.
Yeah, I think Melf teleported Curly to Chendal.
Yeah, and that would have been a saving of a few days at least over the transportation, them hanging around, getting transported to Tensor, taking the water dragons. You know, that would be, you know, that's very interesting there, that I wonder if we're going to hear what Curly was doing. Now, we have a note here that Buzz has dozens of candidates for the sixes, the greater and the lesser and maybe the hidden, and he pits them against each other. You know, that sounds very reasonable, because I would assume the casualty rate among these minions is pretty high. Uzz, in the first encounter with Buzz, he nearly killed... you know, he nearly killed the one wizard, the least of the greater six, by, you know, his spittle. You know, he spat at him, hit him in the head, but didn't kill him. And, you know, so there must be a very high casual, a big turnover for these guys.
I suspect that Patch and Ormuz would have been killed for their failure anyway.
Oh, yes, I agree. I mean, I'm 100% sure of that. I mean, especially since they were supposed to get that middle key and bring Obmi back. And instead, what happens is Obmi gets taken by Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy. And you can see so far they're not in any great hurry to send that artifact over to us.
All they really would have had to do is send some other forces over to say hello to him. But Ormuz wanted to sit and state.
Yes. Now that I think is, you know, a fairly reasonable mistake. You know, it's just something that is very, you know, a very human nature. I was just playing a war game about the Mexican-American War. And the Mexicans had a huge advantage in numbers, but most of their equipment, military equipment, especially the artillery, was very old. And what the U.S. had, they had better rifles and they had better cannon, by quite a deal. And there was this battle of Palo Alto where the general, the Mexican general, pulled back because he had lost a lot of his cavalry, and then the American cannons just raked his lines. And I think there were only like five or six Americans killed, and there were about 350 of the Mexican army. And so in the next battle, he set up a really good position, and this general, while the attack was going on, while the battle was going on, he did not leave his tent. He just sat in his tent for the whole battle, which they lost, and didn't come out to the very end when they had to retreat. And it effectively neutered the force of the Mexican army because they had no overall commanding officer. He just sat in his tent. So you get these things where there are good examples of where, it's like, why? Why would you do these things? And there was a lot of things done just out of pride. And in the real world where you'd think it would just be, that's just crazy. But that's the way it was. So I could really see Ormuz wanting to sit in state and receive Abmi, and everything Abmi said perfectly true, that he'd want to take the second artifact and take credit for it.
And yeah, he definitely would have taken it.
And Abmi had been, in that respect, had followed Uz's orders completely. He hadn't broached that second artifact. He had just hidden it on his person and taken it away. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 334, second paragraph. After a bit more discussion, they shared a meager supper and retired. There was much to do now. It was time to get... Oh, no, I'm sorry. Oops. I had read that already. Third paragraph. It was a relatively swift and easy journey. There were none of the evil creatures lurking in the Vesve, although they encountered a cautious group of armed woodsmen, and later a small band of wild elves roaming through the trees seeking any enemies who might still be hiding there. Both companies were suspicious of the five at first, but then gave them much honor and respect for their part in what had occurred. Gord made a point of telling both the chief of the wood dwellers and the elven leader that the dwarf Abmi had borne an object of evil power toward the realm of Uz. That news, he knew, would soon spread throughout the forest. Thus they made their way toward the south, and soon they were near to Tushim again. That evening the two lads averred that they had no desire to ever dwell in that village again. Both were anxious to remain with their three newfound friends. "We will be most useful, won't we, Shad?" Thatch had assured the doubtful Geller. "In return for taking us along and teaching us about weapons and the rest, we'll cook and clean up and care for your gear most thoroughly." "That we will," chimed in Little Shadow, "and we'll never get in the way either." "How will you keep up once we're out of the forest?" asked Chirp. That put a damper on the boys, both boys' plans, but only for a moment. "I think we can manage," said Shad earnestly to his bigger comrade. "If they'll allow us to put our gear on their horses." "Right," Thatch said, understanding his friend's direction. "We can trot all day as long as we don't have to tote all that stuff too." Chert laughed, for he had no intention of making these two lads run behind their horses. The barbarian had already decided that both boys would make sound warriors and hunters with proper training and guidance, and he would see they got it when they arrived at Tushim tomorrow. Chert had plans to find a pair of small horses for them to ride, and he'd see them properly accoutred in the process. They would earn their gear and keep through service. Great. So here, I think, is a really good example of how zero-level characters can start up, and I've said that before, but also how, we get people who are henchmen. I've always liked that, the addition of henchmen to a game. It's always been really enjoyable. I always liked the business of rescuing possible henchmen from, like in the G1, where there are the prisoners. And there's several NPCs that you can turn even into player characters if you need to, but they work out wonderfully as little additions and maybe even reinforcements when you really need them at that point in the game. All right, but then also you do sometimes worry about getting somebody like Blanc, who's a spy and a traitor to your cause. All right. This is page 335, the second paragraph. The bard had no such intentions, for his duty was to return to his homeland and report there to his liege lord. Unwilling to deflate their hopes and unaware of Chert's resolve, Geller merely grunted non-committedly and let the whole thing pass. Master Gord, what do you say? Shad begged. All right, break here. I wonder where Geller's homeland is. Now, he's House of Geller. That means the Ernst, you know, the county and duchy of Ernst, they're Geller-controlled. But is his homeland actually Nyrond? And it's where basically the two Ernsts are really under the thumb of Nyrond. All right. Restart 335, paragraph 4. Having no desire to teach these boys the dark ways of thieving and swindling in the crowded city, Gord shrugged the pleading query off. Who can say what will come to pass, lads? I'm no lover of battles, nor am I much skilled at the hunt. Let us see what we shall see. The brawny hillman was disappointed at his comrade's response to the entreaties of the two. Come now, he admonished Gord. This is not the way to repay the loyalty of these lads. Of course you can remain with us, boys, he said to the two. Happy and satisfied, the pair rolled up for sleep, and the men soon took their example. If they were to make Tushim on the morrow, they would have to start early and keep up a good pace. They had not gone far the next morning when the horses began to behave abnormally. The animals began snorting and rolling their eyes nervously, and it was difficult to keep them from bolting. Thus alerted, the three men loosened their weapons and sought signs of some beast or enemy that might be near, but there were none to be seen. This is odd, Geller said. I'd have sworn that the animal scented something, but there is no sound nor trace of any predator or lurking humanoid. They certainly act as if they smell something most dire, Chert said. My nose is keen enough, but I scent nothing. Gord, if you use that cat's nose of yours. Not this time, the young thief said to his later regret. I'll not be taking a different shape before an audience of gaping churls. Geller almost used his own power to take animal form himself, so as to see what made the steed so uneasy. But there was no time, for even as he contemplated it, all three horses bolted. Thatch and Shadow were riding while Gord and Chert walked. They had just switched, and the animals seemed to have calmed somewhat. Then, without any warning, they took to galloping. The bard had no choice but to try to regain control of his horse, then catch those of the lads and rein them in as well. In seconds he was out of sight, and the two young adventurers were left standing in startled uncertainty. This, in turn, was shattered by a horrible sound that came rushing toward them from the woods nearby. Or Chert roared in warning, lowering his spear as he said it. There was a crashing, and a bristling form rushed toward them. The thing was larger than a wizened and had tusks as long as a man's forearm. Its rush bowled over a sapling, and the earth shook under the impact of its huge cloven hooves. Gord had time to think that a boar larger than an auroch was impossible, and then it was upon them. Chert's aim was true, but the point of his spear barely scraped the creature's chest. There was a loud report as the spear shaft splintered, and then the animal was passed. The barbarian had been knocked backward by the onslaught, and he lay stunned and bleeding against the base of a tree. As the monstrous boar rushed upon him, Gord had sprung aside, jabbing it automatically with the spear he had gained from the enemy. The metal of the weapon was enchanted, but it only tore a shallow gash along the creature's flank as it went past. That was sufficient to make it bellow in rage. The huge swine weighed a ton and more. Gord guessed, yet it stopped its mad charge, and it turned more quickly than the young thief would have imagined possible. Then it paused for a second, its little eyes glowing with both rage and a cunning that was more disturbing than its fearful tusk and impossible bulk. Gord shuddered, but kept the magical spear aimed squarely at the monster's head. "Come on, pig. I have steel for you to eat." The boar shook its barrel-sized head, sending a spray of foam flying. The huge mouth opened, and the thing spoke. "That twig you waved so bravely will serve only to pin your own ass, manling," it snarled, and with that it came again. The thing went from stillness to full charge in a step, and it was all Gord could manage to leap out of its path and avoid the razor-edged tusks with which it meant to cut him to pieces. He was unhurt, but there'd been no chance to so much as take a poke at the monster with the spear. The boar thing had halted its rush again, and stood with its terrible little eyes locked on Gord. "It is good to have a test," it said in its thick, grunting voice. "I had never thought to find one of you as agile as a monkey." And it laughed a slobbering, squealing laugh that made Gord's blood run cold. Sensing an advantage, the devil boar rushed again at that very moment. All right, break. There's a few comments here. Yes, Chris writes that, Shadow and Thatch were a very good addition, and they were. They've livened up the story quite a bit, and they've added, different things to, both the game material and the story. It gave good examples of how you train from 0 to 1 and how you develop a henchman. Now, also that Geller is a noble of Nyrond, and his liege lord is King Archbold. All right, so yeah, that makes sense. The Gellers are really involved not only with the Ernst, but also with Nyrond. All right. So there's a couple things here with the bull. This, of course, is the devil boar that was talked about much earlier. It's being done very interestingly. It's a talking boar. Now, it's also mentioned that it is larger than a wisent. Now, W-I-S-E-N-T. I'm not quite sure offhand what that is. But an auroch was a type of, I believe it was a type of, steer, an auroch bull. Something like on the par with like saber-toothed tiger, it was a gigantic version. But I have seen it in later day just used to mean that it's something gigantic, like a normal beast, but also, very a huge one, and almost like a Ice Age throwback. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 337. All right. And it is 1, 2, 3, 4. Fifth paragraph, down from the top. Its charge caught Gord this time, one tusk leaving a bloody trail across his chest and arm as it went past. It whirled and tried again. But this time Gord was too quick, and the monstrous thing thundered past harmlessly. There was no chance to strike it, but now Gord was beginning to time the thing's rushes. The gigantic boar watched him again, running its prehensile tongue over its one bloody tusk while it did so. "Yes," it said, as much to itself as to Gord. "I will drink all of your blood, little man, before I devour your flesh." There was more promise in the tone than threat. That tongue belonged to no pig. What are you, boar thing? It is clear you're no swine, wear type or otherwise. You'll never tell it, but know that I am what humans call a Rakshasa, not one of the weaklings which are so known to Yurok, but a true one of my kind. I come from the nine hells to feast, and bring woe to all here on this plain you call Earth. It rumbled in its hideous voice. Gord spat at it, striking it full in one of its mean, fiery eyes. I'm happy to know that, pighead, for I've never killed one of your sort before. He spoke with confidence he did not feel, and hoped that nothing betrayed the fear that was inside him. The spittle and taunting brought the monster rushing again, and this time Gord not only avoided its attack, but stuck the spear well into its rear ham as it went past. This caused the devil pig to emit another ear-hammering squeal. Now it gnashed its jaws hideously, and slavered and foamed as it did so. Eyes fixed on the young man who stood before it with a gore-tipped spear, the thing advanced slowly. It needed no run to gut this puny opponent with its curved tusks. There was a sound of angry hornets, and a meaty thunking sound came at its conclusion. Chirk, with his legs streaming blood and a great bump showing redly on his head, had regained consciousness and attacked while the monster's attention was fixed on Gord. His broad-bladed axe Brule was buried in the creature's bristling shoulder. The barbarian gave a heave, his hugely muscled arms straining to free the embedded weapon. Incredibly, the Rakshasa seemed to shrug the blow off. The axe came free, but Chert lost his grip as the boar thing jerked toward him. Gord had no choice. If he did not distract the monster, it would tear his friend to pieces. The devil boar was intending to do just that. It spun on its splayed hooves and began to rush toward Chert. The barbarian was scrambling madly to retrieve his fallen axe, and he would never be able to get clear before the thing had him. Gord lunged, striking just behind the creature's massive ribcage, hoping that the spear would sink into its lungs or heart. Despite this attack, the monster savaged Chert terribly before it turned to deal with the one who had dealt it such a wound. "That brings your death," it rumbled through its bloody mouth. It was bleeding from its wounds, but it seemed no slower or weaker than before. It began to stalk Gord slowly, as if playing cat and mouse with the young adventurer. Although his friend was unmoving, Gord doubted that the demon boar had had time to finish the hardy barbarian with its terrible attack. Gord kept away from it, still taunting the thing, and jabbing at its eyes with the spear. He knew he couldn't keep the game up much longer, however, for a single misstep in a second, Gord wished he could somehow assume his leopard form. Then he would show the blundering pig what a fight to the death was all about. It was escape by vaulting into the trees, but that would allow the monster time to kill, even devour Chert. Gord had to stand man versus devil. It nearly had him the next moment, as a fallen branch caught his foot for just a split second. The thing lunged, but as it did so, another spear flew through the air and struck it on its wounded shoulder. The weapon bounced harmlessly off, but it saved Gord's life. Geller had come back. "Geller, stay back," Gord shouted urgently to the bard. "It is a devil pig, just as the villagers claimed." The one-eyed man had removed his eye patch, Gord noted, and his long-bladed sword was in hand. "I see it, Gord," the bard said loudly. "It is a small and stinking little thing hiding within that great blubbery body." Gord jabbed and struck home on the distracted creature, and it gave a bellowing squeal of pain at the attack. The spear had bitten deeply into the Rakshasa's jowl, slicing the skin there in such a manner as to reveal its teeth where its flesh had been cut away. That was sufficient to make it completely ignore the newcomer and concentrate all of its savagery on Gord. It came at a trot, and there was nowhere for the young thief to go this time. Praying, he placed the butt of his weapon against the ground, pointing its tip at the monster's heart. Bracing himself as he did so, Gellert did his best to divert the Rakshasa. He ran forward, sword extended for use as a spear, and yelling mightily as he came. This failed to make the monster waver. With a squealing that spewed bloody drops ahead of its charge, the devil boar came forward in an instant. The sound it made as the rigid spear struck its chest and drove into its body was more terrible than any the bard had ever heard. Just as a true boar filled with killing lust would have done, this creature came forward, disregarding the spear that had mortally wounded it. Its charge carried it to where Gord stood, and the tusks and teeth tore through chest and throat in a welter of fountaining blood. The spear went through the monster's whole body, heart, innards, all, as it killed the man before it. The thing itself died. The horror of the scene froze Gellert for a second, and as he stood transfixed, the Rakshasa seemed to deflate. Black blood poured from mouth and wounds as its legs stiffened and kicked in death. The spear was protruding from its chest and rear, but the man it had just killed so horribly, there was no trace save a pool of red. That break. That is the end of chapter 31. And my, what an excellent fight. And
it was very well done.
So I'm very impressed. That was a very entertaining fight right there. And I can see its charge must do a stunning attack. It's because it's now knocked out Chert twice. And here it supposedly mashed Gord into a smear of blood. So again, at least what Gellert sees right there, quite a tremendous fight and a casualty. It shows you why those boar spears have the cross pieces to keep from them from running up a spear. It was actually a boar hunt that killed Genghis Khan. It was one of the last thing he did. He went on a boar hunt with his followers, and he died during the hunt. But that's exactly the way he would have liked going. All right. I'm going to restart. Oh,
they
I'm
said,
sorry.
Yeah, just some little. They said the boar weighed more than a ton.
So yes.
I can see it easily stunning him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it also had the ability to make those short, fast charges. So it could spin on a dime and then charge so quickly that Gord had a very hard time responding except to avoid the charge. So that is, that is part of wargaming. I don't know how much there. I believe there was rules for, lance charging and stuff, but I don't remember where. Normally, you have to go a certain distance to build up the charge speed, But the boar is just going a very minimal distance, turning around and charging at full speed again. Now, normally a Rakshasa appears as a tiger and as a man-shaped tiger.
All right. I guess they can assume any shape.
I remember there was a episode of that Kolchak show that
Night
had
Stalker.
Night Stalker that had a Rakshasa in it. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 341. the beginning of chapter 32. We're starting with paragraph 1. The demon Kostchi, the most powerful if despised lord of the abyss, offered alliance to both Grast and Yinogu, the demon lord of Knolls. This triumvirate, together with a dozen lesser beings who had made common cause prior to this pact, now held sway over fully 66 layers of the place. Certain other powerful demons of great stature supported the alliance, sending their servants and soldiers to the three. A gate was opened between Earth and the world where giants ruled. Bands of mighty hill, mountain, and frost giants roamed from the howling hills southward. Before them they drove the regiments of orcs and hobgoblins, who had sought to hold the land for the Hierarchs. These troops fled into the Fellreeve, or way into the open steppes where the rovers of the barons allowed them no mercy. Some took service with the kinglets of the bandit states to the east, for much of their territory had been freed of the grip of the Hierarchs but recently, and even troops such as these were acceptable to the newly returned rulers there. Many regiments managed to return southward to Molag, though, where they thought there would be safety. Most died there. The city was soon under siege. First, the wild kin of these humanoids made up the bulk of the attackers, but soon enough things were far worse than troll and ogre. Bugbear and Knoll were there. The masters of the Hierarchs summoned monstrous creatures from the lower plains to fortify the defense of Molag. Hideous hordlings rubbed shoulders with even worse daemons of all sorts, and the awful Dumedans of Tartarus. In answer to this, the besieging force was sent demons when they cried for aid. The retreat of Uz's forces became a sudden advance again, as hundreds upon hundreds of demons of all manner were loosed to combat the Hierarch's reinforcements from Tartarus, Hades, and Gahanna. Not only were these forces outnumbered, but many hordlings, secretly despising their masters and favoring the chaos of the abyss, went over to Uz. Men and humanoids, even those of power or fearsomeness, stayed low and did nothing as demons fought daemons, hordlings who were hordlings or demodans, and were rent in turn. Monstrous forms hopped and ran, crawled and wiggled, flapped and fluttered in a terrible dance of death and destruction around the city of Molag. Many demons died, but still more came daily until the whole place was ringed with them, and the air above the city became unsafe for any who did not serve the abyss. Then the Dukes of Hell took an interest in what was happening. They sent legions of their service to assist the masters of the Hierarchs because their cause was one with Nerol and the rest. Cohorts of Ibishay, blue, red, green, black, and white devils of winged sort appeared in the sky to contest with the demons there. From spine devils to mighty pit fiends, the nine hells sent forth their companies. Those who had lesser power died, destroyed forever, whether daemon, demon, demondad, hordling, devil, or any other of the foulness being belched up from the vile lower plains. The terrible battle raged day and night for a week. When it finally ended, all the things summoned were dead or returned to their own places. It had to be thus, or else the great rulers would be drawn into the contest, and none, demon, devil, or otherwise, cared to risk this over some petty piece of the prime material plane at this particular conjunction of probability. The hells were satisfied that they had checked their abyssal foes. There was time enough to take from the demon spawned Uz that which he had stolen. Nerol seized with fury at the setback. But Tartarus wavered, and if he continued to fight openly, then more likely than not, other of the lords of the abyss would unite to oppose the conjunction of evil. The Reaper, too, decided to bide his time. Molag fell to the mundane armies of Uz. The Cambion's realm now extended from the Dulce River in the west to the verge of the Felreed Forest and the banks of the Retensa in the east. The Rid of Uz extended northward to the Cold Marshes and south to the Vang River and the border marches of Furiondi and the Shieldlands. Bandit lordlings now pledged their fealty to Uz, while ambassadors from the nomads of the cold northwestern plains and the strange realm of Blackmoor came with gifts and offers of alliance. Even the master of the distant holding called Stonefist considered such steps. So great was the fame which came to the Cambion upon his overthrow of the Hierarchs. Of the Hierarchs themselves, not even Uz knew for certain. Those who had served these men had either died or taken service under their new master. Some few escaped, of course, for the 10 had surely managed to flee somewhere. Rumor said that they had been carried far to the south, but nothing was known beyond this tale. As the month of sunset brought the chill of winter to the land, the ones who opposed evil wondered what would follow. Perhaps the night and cold would be upon earth forever soon, and spirits dimmed and hearts grew heavy at this prospect. Otherwise, though, understanding full well the contest between chaos and the rest of evil, were glad for the seeming victory of badness. These wise leaders sent messages of encouragement to the others who neared despair. When evil fights evil, good folk prosper. Do not lose heart, for Uz truly stands between us and a world of utter darkness. There is hope yet. It was not all well with Uz. The victories were hollow to the Cambion, for he had to share them with the two women who seemed determined to make his existence a hell. No, worse than that, ordered and regimented as it was, Uz thought that such would almost be preferable to what he suffered. Aegwyl held the second key and would not give it to him. With it in her possession, Uz dared not argue strongly, let alone attempt force. Zuckmoy, meanwhile, directed his every move. With Aegwyl's advice and blessing, it was intolerable. Only he knew that somehow he must tolerate it all, biding his moment, the time when he actually gained the second key and stood above the two who rolled him as he had rolled others. Winter howled over Daraka, and Uz wished that the reconstruction of his new palace at Molag were done, so at least he could enjoy the benefits of that warmer clime. Thinking of the fair shores of the Pomarge, where snow never fell, Uz wandered off to the dungeons below his dreadful palace in Doraka to see if a little amusement there might cheer him up. All right, break. That is the end of chapter 32. Now, there's quite a few different things. So, this really is where they did get a lot of the Greyhawk Wars ideas from. And it's very hard to counter that, you know, Gygax himself destroyed the Hierarchs. Now, he's also, at this point, I think, planning to destroy the entire Earth. But I don't know for sure. I mean, at some point, he's gone over to New Infinities. So I really wonder that, you know, that might be it right there. But they did come and take New Infinities away from him. I don't know. It was a very odd thing for this to be all about Tharizdun and, which would end up in total destruction. Now, one of the things here that I find very interesting is that that Doraka is in this season, and I think we're given the season right here, is cold. Molag is much warmer. And the coasts of the Pomarge never get snow. So, if you're working out the various weathers, then we can take that as a, you know, as a good thing. So Sunseb just ended. All right, so in Sunseb, we're going to see cold weather in Daraka, better weather in Molag, and which it surprises me because it seems pretty close to Daraka. And then all the way at the coast of the Pomarge, there's never going to be any snow. So, you know, I think that should be a good addition to try to work out. And you have to remember, this is a fantasy world. You're not going to be able to get all things fitting into how things work on Earth. There's going to be reasons or magical reasons or just, it just is not the same. And I if it doesn't make sense, then you really need to shift it to make sense or just abandon it and go with like a real world Earth and change everything. But Gygax is making some particular statements right here. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 345, the beginning of chapter 33 and the first paragraph. Returning the former captains took several weeks. Moon and his friend and longtime fellow mercenary Patrick would not have it any other way. They saw most of the women and girls safely to their respective homes. Of course, they were given rewards, the compensation being a few coppers or a gold orb, depending on the financial capability of the grateful relatives concerned. In the process, Patrick won the favor of a nice-looking lass from a small village in the Viscounty of Verbabank. Nothing would do but that she be returned home last, of course, and Moon cheerfully agreed to the plan. Eventually, the three brought their weary horses to the stable of the girl's home. Her father was a well-off swordsmith, and he took an instant liking to his prospective son-in-law, Patrick, and Moon most happily received as well. After they had spent several weeks with this man, nuptials were agreed to, and a date set. Not much later, Patrick and the girl were married and settled in a cottage not far from the establishment of the swordsmith. Moon, being reluctant to leave the town, looked for gainful employment, for Patrick had already established a school for weapon use in the village. In due course, Moon joined the local militia, and he was soon appointed chief of the local watch and captain of the militia as well. For these services, he received ample compensation and was quite content. Eventually, he too... Eventually, he too found true love with a cousin of his friend Patrick's family and was soon married and raising children. Far away in Hardby, Deirdre returned. Although she had taken no part in the quest for the artifact of all evil, or an insignificant part at best, she was received as a heroine by the matriarch. Despotrix no longer being a fashionable title, the ruler of that place styled herself thus. Deirdre was given the post of justiciar of the realm, and her brother Oscar was appointed as demon crafter of all Hardby. Neither found the offices or their lives totally satisfactory, but then few mortals are given such satisfaction anyway. They were pleased enough and received much honor and accolades in their offices. I am a little interested that I thought Oscar was a cousin, but I guess he's, maybe I'm mistaken, and he is the brother. All right. And I like the business with Patrick and Moon right here. All right, I'm going to continue. It's page 346, third paragraph. A dark-skinned warrior took service with a caravan going east from the frontier of Furiundi to the Shieldlands. It was a long, slow trip. He left word at many villages and towns, and sought information too, but none knew of the ones he sought. In the process, though, he met many other men-at-arms who earned their bread by offering their sword for hire. The best of these he recruited, some for positions with the merchant's train of goods, others personally. He was now called Captain Nkosi, and the company he commanded was to be known as the Bronze Band. Nkosi himself was the color of old bronze, and he chose for a device a bronzewood tree. Deep brown and green were the homely colors of the company's cloaks and tabards. Although they had but small repute, Nkosi and his new free company found employment in the Shieldlands, for the robber lords to the north were active, and many reaving parties were being sent down to harry the lands around. The Bronze Band proved itself repeatedly against brigands and vicious humanoids alike. Soon its renown was such that the brown and green of its emblems were a byword throughout the whole of the territory. Great deeds were done by the company, and powerful fighting men and spell workers were proud to serve with it. Nkosi was knighted by the Earl himself, and the Flan captain sat in council with lords and generals. The half-elven ranger and druid Greenleaf called Curly by his friends because of the anomaly of being bald-pated and having elvish blood, strived to enable the faction he served to gain the second portion of the artifact that would enable the unchaining of the greatest evil imaginable. Although the druids and the cabals above them were as neutral in their philosophy as Mordenkainen, they were, at least for the time, totally disinterested in the item itself. They desired most of all to retain the balance, not to gain the power of the artifact for their own ends. Despite the best efforts of them all, they failed. In the process, however, Greenleaf worked with dedication and a self-sacrificing that did not pass unnoticed. Upon returning to his master to relate what had transpired, the half-elf was made to rest and to spend many weeks in study and meditation. Thereafter, Greenleaf was elevated to a position of rare honor and great responsibility. He became one of only three who directly served the Grand Druid of the Flaness. Greenleaf was now an arch-druid, and he roved the lands round as the great priest of nature directed. They waited for 2 days, but no trace of their lost friend Gord could be found, and there was no sign of him. Gellar decided it was time they must leave. Chert was reluctant, but he also knew that the bard was correct. Duty demanded they be elsewhere, and tarrying 2 days was near dereliction. When Thatch and Shadow asked what had happened, neither of the men was able to explain. The devil in Boar's form was dead. Of that there was no question. They skinned it while they waited, and saved its huge head for a trophy. What was left they burned, and even the ashes of that fire were buried thereafter. This the lads knew and understood. All that remained of Gord, however, was the enchanted spear with which he had slain the devil pig. Not even a trace of his blood was discernible after an hour. It was as if it had been absorbed by nature. That the black stain of the Rakasha's blood remained only added to the mystery. They all agreed that somehow things must not be as they appeared, because all traces of their young comrade could not disappear without some causative agent at work. Gellar did not mention to the others that the agent could be diabolical. "I'll keep the spear, Gellar, and if Gord ever returns, it will be ready for his use. Otherwise, it is a memento mori, which the dogs of evil will wish to forget as they die." "Sure, I find that most fitting," the one-eyed bard told them. "Where will you go with the spear?" "Back to the hills of my homeland, and the fair trees of the Adri, and both of the lads will like it there, I'm sure." "You'll have company then, my friend," the bard replied. "I must ride all the way to the distant walls of Radagast City, and this seems a good hour to set forth on that journey." The boys rode double upon Gord's horse, while the huge barbarian and the bard carried their trophies, head and hide, respectively, with them. They reached Tushim soon enough, And the whole village turned out to receive them when word was known of who was with the two men and what they bore. In exchange for two swift little horses, tack, and provisions, they left a few coins and the monster's head in Tushim. The unusual aspect of the devil boar was evident to all who saw it, so the gigantic head became the most famous trophy in the village. Soon folk flocked to Tushim to view the remains of the Rakasha, and the establishment it hung in waxed prosperous indeed. Although neither of the boys had had a hand in slaying the devil boar, mere association with the men who brought it in its carcass was sufficient renown. Tushim would gladly have received both Thatch and Shadow as heroes, clasping them to themselves at least for a time. Neither cared to say, despite all this, for even had Clydebow proved true and made them apprentice hunters, as he vowed he would do, the lads wanted no part of it. They would see the world and remain with Chert. They rode away amid the tears of kinfolk and cheers from the rest of the village. Although Geller had used his heart to heal the terrible wounds his comrade had sustained in the fight with the Rakasha, the bard insisted that the hide belong to Chert for his part in the combat. A petty demon crafter in Tushim had placed spells upon the huge skin so that it would not rot before they found a place to have it dried and cured. In the course of their long journey, they had it properly preserved. Then Chert decided that the hide must be put to some proper use. Nothing would do for it to be worked into articles they would wear to battle. Geller demurred, but eventually the bard accepted a broad belt made from a strip of the thing's hide. Chert wore a cuir boule jack of the stuff and thick bracers thereafter. The sleeveless cuirass was incredibly tough and could never wear out, it seemed, while it had a strange property of lessening blows. Both Thatch and Shad were given leather caps to wear, and the remainder of the devil boar's huge hide covered shields they eventually bore. The four made their long ride eastward with few incidents along their route. When they finally crossed the rolling waters of their Atonsime, Geller bid them farewell and headed south for the Palatine county of Ernst. Chert and his two young charges watched the bard until he was out of sight, and then they continued on eastward. Their destination was many, many leagues distant, but they viewed the journey still to come as a marvelous experience. The quest for the second key of the artifact of all evil was ended. Now the epilogue. See ya, Chris. Sorry we didn't finish up just for that. All right. Now we're past 7 here, and we've just got the epilogue's 2 pages right here. A vaulted ceiling with beams of natural logs supporting it came gradually into focus. It was softly lit by sunlight streaming in somewhere, but there was no strength to allow an attempt to discover the source. A warm breeze played over his body, and this felt wonderful. It made him aware of the softness of the stuff upon which he lay. Ford gathered his strength and slowly blinked his eyes. Their focus was sharper now. Who am I? He wondered. There was no answer to his mind, so he gave up and allowed himself to drift again into the comforting drowse that washed over brain and body as a soft little wave gently covers a sandy shore. Time passed. How long a time he had no idea. But with its passage came a new awakening. This brought new alertness. His eyes could move. He felt every part of his body. And he knew his name. Suddenly a beautiful face framed by a mane of tawny hair appeared above him. The eyes smiled and the red lips spoke. Only 7 remain to you now, so use them wisely, the voice said, and a pair of lovely lips kissed his forehead softly. Harib? Yes, Gord. Where? He started to ask weakly. But the beautiful female answered before he could finish. Safe, and becoming sound at the manse of the Cat Lord, of course. Where else could you be after using one of the special lives he granted for you? The devil bore, it killed me, I remember now. The fear and the awful pain as again Tirup silenced him, this time with her long, cool fingers placed gently on his mouth. Hush, Gord, don't think of that now. Later, when you are stronger, there will be time. I'm anxious to hear all about it, too, she said with real enthusiasm. Cat Lord knows a little, but he wishes to hear the whole tale as soon as you're able to tell it. When do you think that will be? Gord asked her. Now that you have awakened from the comatose sleep of your regeneration, I think you'll be up and around in a few days, even if you'll be weak as a newborn cub. Yes, I think you're right. I feel ravenous, Tirup, and very thirsty, too. Help me to sit up and see if there isn't something for me to eat around here. Just like a male, Tirup said with mock exasperation, always expecting the female to serve them one thing or another. She gently helped Gord to sit up, placing fluffy pillows of down behind him and straightening the soft sheet that covered his scarred body. Don't worry, those will fade into nothing more than little lines in a day or two, Tirup said when she noticed him looking at the places where the Rakshasa had torn open his belly and chest. Food, Gord cried with feigned supplication. And some fresh milk to help your body regain its natural strength, Tirup said firmly. You must eat and rest and, Gord repeated, wondering what else he could possibly do. Tirup looked at him with a gaze that reminded Gord of a cat eyeing a mouse. And then show me how you can turn into a huge panther, handsome, she said. Then she was gone in a whirl. Gord lay back and thought about that for a long time. And that is the end. Okay, so unfortunately we lost a lot of the audience in one go here, but we're still finishing this up. A couple things, and as is mentioned right here, Geller is returning to Radagast City. So I'm kind of thinking that he is actually more in the service of the Gellers than in the service of the King of Nyrond. Now the House of Geller is Belisica of the Countess of Ernst and Carol, the Duke of Duchy of Ernst. So I'm thinking that there we're going to have Geller serving them rather than Nyrond itself. But Radagast City is on its way to Nyrond, so maybe it's not definitely stated. Gord's used another of his, rings of regeneration. He's got 9 lives in this game. He's used up 2 of them. And I really enjoyed the business with the Devil Pig's hide, the equipment that was made out of it. It's something really to think about, encouraging, 1 life per book. I think it's something to think about whenever your players encounter some special monster. In some way, it'd be nice if they realized that they could have some special equipment made from it. But like even here, the Devil Pig needed something to preserve it before it rotted away. So there's a lot of little things that, Gygax has thought about here. Overall, this was a much better story. But as you can see, this is 33 hours, 33 recordings. So we really did not get the chance to go. There was a lot of exposition. There was a lot of dialogue. There was a lot of, action. And that, while enjoyable, isn't necessarily going to bring a lot of commentary to it. So in the end here, we've really had, I think, a wonderful conclusion. And honestly, the series could end here. Wouldn't have to have gone any further than this. And in a way, I wish Gygax had gone in a different direction and started writing about simpler things. you know, lower level adventures, adventuring groups, maybe running over some of the more classic adventures that are out there, different characters. And I would have enjoyed that in a story form and probably a lore form as well. Much better than the direction it went. There are five more books. The one is an anthology that takes us back, so they're not, Chert and Gord aren't overpoweringly strong. Sea of Death, you know, is a very good story. So there's a lot to look forward to, but I wish Gygax had written like 50 books and that they had been about a variety of characters and things. All right, so that is it. I am going to summon up Craig, and that is going to be it for Artifact of Evil. And tomorrow, I'm going to be starting Sea of Death. That is the third book in publication order.